I'm Amy Goodman, and host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Latino history is American history. And to tell that full story, and tell a full history, we need to acknowledge our colonial past.
As the nation marks Hispanic Heritage Month, we look at a brewing controversy over the creation of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Latino. We'll speak to two historians who'd been hired to create a temporary exhibition about Latino civil rights of the 1960s. But the museum shelved the exhibit after coming under criticism by conservative Latinos. Instead, the museum is now working on an exhibit about salsa music. But first, Chilean President Gabriel Boric made a historic trip to Washington, D.C. over the weekend to mark the 50th anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup in Chile. Boric visited the site in Washington, D.C., where in 1976, agents of the Pinochet dictatorship assassinated the former Chilean diplomat Orlando Letelier and his colleague Ronnie Moffitt of the Institute for Policy Studies.
And when some people dare to ask the victims to silence their grief, to turn the page, I would humbly like to tell them, having spoken to many of those victims, that this reconciliation is only possible with truth and justice, not with forgetting.
We'll speak to Orlando Letelier's son, Juan Pablo Letelier, a former state senator in Chile. He's just returned to Santiago from Washington, D.C. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 20 people were killed, nearly 300 others hospitalized Monday as an explosion ripped through a fuel depot for refugees in the South Caucasus territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. It's not clear what caused the blast, which added to the misery of tens of thousands of ethnic Armenians fleeing the disputed territory 1 week after it was seized by Azerbaijan. Armenian officials report nearly 14,000 of Nagorno-Karabakh's 120,000 residents had fled to Armenia as of Tuesday morning. Thousands remain without food, shelter, and clean sources of drinking water.
We don't know what happens to us next. We don't know what the government has in store for us. There is not a single chance to go back. If there were chances, we would not leave in the first place. It is very dangerous there.
On Monday, representatives of Karabakh Armenians met with Azerbaijani officials for a second round of peace talks. No details about the meeting were made public. In Baku, Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, pledged his government would ensure the security of everyone in Nagorno-Karabakh, countering Armenia's claims that ethnic cleansing is underway.
The people living in the Karabakh region are Azerbaijan citizens regardless of their nationality. Their safety, security, well-being will be ensured by the state of Azerbaijan.
Diplomatic officials from Armenia and Azerbaijan are in the Belgian capital of Brussels today to prepare for October 5th peace talks. The summit will include the leaders of France, Germany, and the European Council. Ukrainian officials say Russian airstrikes and artillery fire killed six people and destroyed grain storage infrastructure at the Black Sea port of Odessa Monday. The damage further degrades Ukraine's abilities to export food and fertilizer to world markets 2 months after Russia withdrew from a deal that granted safe package to agricultural exports. Monday's attacks came as Ukraine's military said it's confirmed the deaths of the top commander of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, along with 33 other officers in a Ukrainian missile attack on Russian-occupied Crimea last week. The Kremlin claims just one member of the Russian military is missing after the attack. Meanwhile, the United Nations Independent Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine says investigators have found continued evidence of war crimes committed by Russian forces in Ukraine. The commission's chair, Eric Moes, testified to the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva Monday.
The use of torture by Russian armed forces in areas under their control has been widespread and systematic. Further, the Commission has found that in the Kherson region, Russian soldiers raped and committed sexual violence against women of ages ranging from 19 to 83 years, often together with threats of commission or other violations.
In immigration news, Mexico has accepted demands from the Biden administration to start deporting migrants who are apprehended in northern Mexico border cities back to their home countries. Mexico's government has also agreed to enforce over a dozen policies to block migrants and asylum seekers from reaching the United States. This comes as U.S. immigration officials have reported a sharp increase in the number of people attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in recent weeks, as thousands seek protection from violence, conflict, extreme poverty, and the impacts of the climate crisis. The mayor of El Paso, Texas, has said his city is at a breaking point, as shelters are at capacity, forcing many asylum seekers onto the streets. Another Texas border city, Eagle Pass, has extended its state of emergency declaration as thousands of asylum seekers have arrived in recent days. Meanwhile, immigration rights advocates have denounced the Biden administration for deploying more military personnel to the southern border and not prioritizing humanitarian relief or addressing the massive backlogs, greatly delaying the processing of asylum and immigration cases. A recent report by Syracuse University found a backlog of some 2.6 million cases in U.S. immigration courts. New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez says he will not resign and will seek to clear his name after he and his wife were indicted Friday on federal bribery charges. On Monday, the embattled Democrat said nearly $500,000 in cash found in his New Jersey home after a raid was being stored for emergency personal use. Menendez did not mention the gold bars and Mercedes-Benz also seized by federal agents, nor did he answer questions from reporters.
I recognize this will be the biggest fight yet, but as I have stated throughout this whole process, I firmly believe that when all the facts are presented, not only will I be exonerated, but I still will be the New Jersey's senior senator.
On Monday, two more Democratic senators, Sherrod Brown of Ohio and Peter Welch of Vermont, called for Menendez to step down. They joined Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman, whose campaign promised to return $5,000 in contributions from a political action committee tied to Senator Menendez in, quote, envelopes stuffed with $100 bills, unquote. Two people have announced they're running against Menendez in next year's election, New Jersey Congressmember Andy Kim and community activist Lawrence Hamm, who's the chair of the People's Organization for Progress. Former President Donald Trump has called for the outgoing chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, to be put to death. Trump made the remark Monday on his social media platform, Truth Social, accusing Milley of secretly speaking to China's government behind his back in the final months of his administration. Trump wrote, quote, "This is an act so egregious that in times gone by, the punishment would have been death." In Georgia, the Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee has granted a request by prosecutors to restrict the release of personal information about jurors in the election interference case against former President Trump and 18 co-defendants. District Attorney Fannie Willis requested additional protections after members of the grand jury who brought the indictments had their home addresses, phone numbers, and other personal information posted online, leading to threats and harassment. Willis and members of her team also received death threats. In Colorado, a judge overseeing a case seeking to bar Donald Trump from the 2024 presidential ballot has issued a protective order barring threats and intimidation. CREW, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, argues Trump is disqualified under a clause of the 14th Amendment that prohibits people from holding office if they've, quote, engaged in insurrection against the United States. Meanwhile, Trump's presidential campaign is denying the former president purchased a Glock pistol during a visit to a gun store in South Carolina Monday. Video widely shared on social media shows Trump admiring the weapon, which was decorated with Trump's name and likeness, and saying he'd like to buy it. Federal law bars the sale of firearms to people who are under indictment for crimes carrying sentences of more than a year, which would include Trump. This comes days after President Biden unveiled a new White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention.
After every mass shooting, we hear a simple message, the same message heard all over the country. And I've been to every mass shooting. Do something. Please do something. Do something to prevent the tragedies and leave behind survivors who will always carry the physical and emotional scars.
The Gun Violence Archive reports nearly 32,000 people across the United States have died from firearms so far this year. 519 people have been killed in mass shootings. Microsoft is on track to complete the largest ever merger of technology firms after British regulators approved its $69 billion purchase of the video game maker Activision Blizzard. This comes after a federal judge in July refused the Biden administration's request to issue a temporary injunction stopping the merger, citing antitrust laws. The Federal Trade Commission argued the merger would hurt competition in the video game industry. Members of SAG-AFTRA have voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike against video game companies. Union negotiators representing about 2,600 performers have been in negotiations for a new interactive media agreement for nearly a year without success. They're seeking wage increases to make up for high inflation and want guarantees against the unregulated use of artificial intelligence. The strike authorization comes as Hollywood actors remain on strike, even after major studios reached a tentative agreement Sunday with screenwriters in the Writers Guild of America. The WGA has paused picketing but remains on strike pending ratification of the contract. WGA leaders are scheduled to vote on the agreement today. Once it's approved, the contract will be made available to about 11,000 union writers to vote on. No talks are currently scheduled between Hollywood studios and SAG-AFTRA actors who've been on strike since July. Libya's top prosecutor ordered the arrest of eight Libyan officials as part of the investigation into the collapse of two dams in the eastern port city of Derna earlier this month. The disaster killed thousands of people after torrential rains triggered by Storm Daniel triggered tsunami-level floods that decimated entire neighborhoods. Thousands of survivors of the floods have held recent protests demanding accountability from government officials as they reportedly ignored mounting warnings that if the dams were not urgently maintained, Derna faced a potential catastrophe. In Canada, hundreds of Sikh community members gathered outside Indian consulates and diplomatic missions across multiple Canadian cities Monday, angered by Canadian government accusations that the government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi was directly involved in the assassination of the prominent Canadian Sikh separatist leader Hardeep Singh Nijjar in June. Nijjar was killed outside a temple in British Columbia. The actions came 1 week after Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said to Parliament there's credible evidence gathered by domestic intelligence linking the Indian government to Nijjar's murder. This is one of the protesters in Toronto.
We would like the Canadian government to completely abolish their embassy and remove it from here because they've already broken international law. They've compromised the safety and sovereignty of Canadians. And the longer they're here, who knows who they're targeting next?
India chose violence. India chose to murder a Canadian on Canadian soil, and they will pay the price.
India has said the accusations are absurd. An investigation is underway after at least one Molotov cocktail was thrown at the Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C. Sunday. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez said on social media the Cuban embassy, quote, was the target of a terrorist attack. No one was injured. The building didn't receive significant damage. There have been no arrests so far. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, the Chilean president, Gabriel Boric, made an historic trip to Washington, D.C. over the weekend to mark the 50th anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup in Chile and the 1976 assassination on U.S. soil of former Chilean diplomat Orlando Letelier and his colleague Ronnie Moffitt of the Institute for Policy Studies, killed by agents of the Pinochet dictatorship. Stay with us. Workers to Power from Paradon Records, Chile, Songs for the Resistance. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with our ongoing coverage of events marking the 50th anniversary of the other September 11th. That's September 11th, 1973, when the U.S.-backed military coup in Chile unfolded that ousted the democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. He died in the palace that day and led to a 17-year repressive dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet. On Saturday, the Chilean president, Gabriel Boric, made a historic trip to Washington, D.C. to visit the site where on September 21, 1976, agents of the Pinochet regime assassinated former Chilean diplomat Orlando Letelier and his colleague Ronnie Moffitt of the Institute for Policy Studies for their work to defend democracy in Chile. Letelier had served as Chile's Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Interior and Defense Minister under Salvador Allende. At the time he was murdered, he was director of the Transnational Institute at IPS, a progressive think tank. This is the late filmmaker and author Saul Landau in a video produced by IPS describing the attack and his close friend Orlando Letelier.
He wanted it work, of course, to bring democracy back to Chile and on human rights in general. And both Mark Raskin and Dick Barnett, who were the co-directors of IPS, thought it was a good idea. And we hired him. He didn't stay all that long because Pinochet blamed him for several of the bad things that were happening to Chile as a result of Pinochet's human rights violations. The Kennedy Amendment, which cut off all arms sales and shipments to Chile, and then the Harkin Amendment, which cut off all the rest except for humanitarian aid. And although Orlando was not responsible for either one of these, Pinochet in his narrow-shaped brain, of course, blamed him. And he ordered the head of the secret police, Manuel Contreras, who was a colonel, to do the job. Contreras, in turn, picked Michael Townley to organize the mission. Nobody who was ever involved with these two people will or could ever forget this horrible day. It was, I remember, a warm, slightly drizzly morning. Orlando's car came to rest just here at the embassy doorstep. Townley had put the bomb at a place in the I-beam where the bomb would blow straight up. Ronnie was sitting in the seat next to him and just took a piece of metal in the throat, and that wiped her out. I just felt an overwhelming sense of sorrow and sadness, but I also felt that we have got to get the people who did this. And there was no question in my mind that the only possible suspect was named Augusto Pinochet. But Pinochet never got his name on that indictment with the signature of the U.S. attorney. And that was a tragic blow to American justice.
That was Saul Landau in a film produced by the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, where Orlando Letelier was working when he was assassinated. The IPS was co-founded by Marcus Raskin, father of Democratic Congressmember from Maryland, Jamie Raskin, who addressed the memorial ceremony Saturday at the site of the 1976 assassination in Sheridan Circle in D.C. The event took place a couple of days after Independent Senator Bernie Sanders joined Democratic Congressmembers Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others to introduce a congressional resolution apologizing for the U.S. role in the 1973 coup and calling for further declassification of U.S. records for related events. Congressmember Raskin spoke after he presented a copy of the resolution to Chilean President Boric.
I was 13 years old when Orlando and Ronnie were killed right here. And I had a message that came to school saying that I should come right home after school. And I was on the bus coming just, well, around Sheridan Circle. And we were stuck for several hours in traffic because it was still a crime scene at that point, and none of us knew what had happened and what was going on. It was before cell phones took place. But I remember going to see Michael Moffitt that night with my parents and with the Barnetts, and I remember Michael reconstructing the details of what had taken place and describing the horror of the explosion in the car. I remember everybody just weeping and not sleeping for days at the loss of Orlando, who everybody loved, and Ronnie, who everybody loved, who often babysat for me and for my siblings. And I remember my dad, and I remember Dick Burnett and Saul Landau and the other fellows holding a press conference and declaring that whatever else would happen, IPS would find the killers of their colleagues and see that justice was done.
That's Congressmember Jamie Raskin, who was also referring to Michael Moffitt, who is the husband, in the car, though not killed, along with Ronnie Moffitt and Orlando Letelier. Also there Saturday with two of Orlando Letelier's sons, including Juan Pablo Letelier, a former member of the Chilean Senate, who will join us in a minute from Santiago. This is what he said Saturday.
Dear friends, this is a site of cultural memory. This is a memory site that has been built during the last 47 years, led by the IPS. This has been a place where the Letelier Moffitt Fund, where fabulous voices have built a memory site. Hands, struggles, who have built what is here today. We as a family are full of gratitude.
After Orlando Letelier's son spoke on Saturday, the Chilean president, Gabriel Boric, addressed the crowd. He began in English.
I have been to a lot of acts of remembrance, and I must confess, I'm really shaking now after hearing Orlando's sons, after hearing that incredible speech, Jamie Raskin, wherever you are, there you are. After feeling this energy here, the Washington crying, but all of us here gathered happy and celebrating life, not death. That's an unequivocal way to say that we won, that Orlando's and Ronnie's ideals won, and we are very proud of us of that. And my generation, I was born 10 years after Orlando was killed. My generation is deeply moved and deeply grateful of the thought they gave, of the life they gave to us.
As Chilean President Gabriel Boric continued his address, he transitioned to Spanish.
Que los golpes de Estado nunca son inevitables.
Coup d'etats are never inevitable. There will always, always be a space for dialogue, for conversation, for respect of different opinions.
Respeto entre quienes piensan distinto. Y hasta el día de hoy,
even today, there are many who continue with impunity. And when some people dare to ask the victims to silence their grief, to turn the page, I would humbly like to tell them, having spoken to many of those victims, that this reconciliation is only possible with truth and justice, not with forgetting, and with the profound agreement and deep conviction that this can never happen again.
We really expect that the U.S. has a reflection, a more deep reflection, and I know that you are doing that, but there's a more deeper reflection on what they pushed in Chile, and not only in Chile, in other places in Latin America.
That was Chilean President Gabriel Boric speaking Saturday in Washington, D.C. at the site of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt's assassination. For more, we're joined by Juan Pablo Letelier, member of the Chilean House and Senate for 32 years, was in high school when his father, Orlando Letelier, was assassinated with U.S. activist Ronnie Moffitt in that car bombing on Embassy Row, September 21st, 1976. Letelier's Socialist Party is also part of President Boric's coalition, joining us now from Santiago, Chile. Still, after all of these years, our condolences to you, your family, your country, Juan Pablo Letelier.
Thank you very much. So, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you with us. If you can talk about, you know, we heard Congressman Raskin talking about him being 13 years old when your dad was assassinated. Can you talk about your experience at that time? Your father was the Chilean ambassador to the United States until 1973, then moved on to be leading critic outside Chile of Augusto Pinochet before he was murdered. Talk about where you were.
I was at high school. We used to live in Bethesda, Maryland. Went to Walt Whitman High School. I was a senior. I was called over to the dean's office or to the principal's office. And when I got there, he mentioned to me that my father had been in an accident. He didn't give me more details. He only mentioned that my aunt was going to come by to pick me up. A little while after she did, two of my brothers were in the car with her. I got in the car, sat in the back seat with one of my brothers, Francisco, who asked me if I knew what had happened. And I told him that I did not. And he simply said, they put a bomb in dad's car. They put a bomb in dad's car. We drove down to or into D.C. to George Washington Hospital. We were listening to news briefs or reports of all types, different information, confusing information, one person dead, two persons dead, no information. When we got to the hospital, there was a lot of people, a lot of press, a lot of confusion. We were kind of hustled in, and suddenly we were in a room with my mother. She came to us. She hugged the three of us that were there. And what she said was, the only thing I ask of all of you is that after all this is over, you won't hate anybody. That was her way of telling us that my father was dead.
And Juan Pablo Letelier, can you talk about the fight afterwards to justice for the people responsible, and especially the long quest to hold Pinochet directly responsible?
This has been a very long, long fight. The Institute for Policy Studies, Saul Landau, along with a journalist, John Dingus, did a big investigation. They searched for information. They picked up information. The FBI also did its effort. There was a trial initially in the U.S. around 78, I will say, which unfortunately, despite all the information being available, it was considered a mistrial, amazingly, where the Cubans who lived in the U.S., who collaborated with Pinochet's police or secret police with the DINA, they were off the hook, unfortunately. They have been identified. This was a big effort through many years. Many human rights workers kept struggling to get justice done. Finally, I'd say thanks to many people who pushed this effort, once we recovered democracy in Chile in 1990s, during the second democratic government we had, just on that occasion, the head of the Chilean secret police, Manuel Contreras,